Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer, classicist, and translator, Sarah Rudin. And we're talking about her book, I Am the Arrow, The Life and Art of Sylvia Plath in Six Poems. Sarah, welcome back to the show. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Now, of all the poets you could write about, what drew you to Sylvia Plath? Not that she's absolutely not, she is worthwhile of writing a book like this, but why Sylvia Plath among others?
Well, I've been a Plath fan since my teens. I'm not sure when I came across her novel, The Bell Jar.
Mm.
I might have been as young as 16. And I was just very impressed by the vividness of her writing and her honesty. Came to the poems somewhat later, but loved them too. She seemed to be women's and girls' own poet.
Well, it's interesting. When I went to college, which is a long time ago, I went to Clark, her poetry was huge, and her novel was too, her autobiographical novel, Bell Jar, and especially among women. And that's led her poetry to be a little bit, as you write in your book, often passed for more of a political cause than a poet, which has not done her reputation any good, I think.
Right. Yeah, or even her, she's even passed for, you know, a rather trashy poet. I remember a friend of mine at Harvard, he's talking about his days at Phillips Exeter. And there was one day a week when all of the kids who were getting therapy were loaded into a van and, you know, taken sort of in bulk to a therapy session. And there was a, you know, beautiful, very neurotic upper-class girl who was who insisted on reading Ariel aloud during these van rides.
Oh, my God.
The great irritation of the boys. So that, in his mind, sort of fixed Sylvia Plath as a rather, you know, trashy, self-indulgent writer. She was the kind of writer that girls like this, you know, spoiled, neurotic, upper-class girls liked.
And I don't understand the reaction, because if you haven't read it, how can you be criticizing it? But it has been very appealing all along through the decades to women, especially young women. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, I totally understand it. But the other thing I will say is, years ago, I heard a recording of her reading one of her poems, and it wasn't one of the ones in your book. And all I know is her voice scared the crap out of me. She was reading that, what's the poem that also includes all sorts of references to all sorts of dark and black things, and her voice, listening to her cadence, just really, first of all, changed my mind a lot about her, and I felt that she was a really frightening poet.
Oh, right. Yes. I'm not sure what poem that was. Maybe Poem for a Birthday.
Yeah.
There are recordings of her in the Poetry Center in Lamont Library.
It was. I got this on a poetry compilation of poets reading their works live, and all I know is it was not what I expected. And so, it was pretty interesting to hear her read her poems.
Yeah, she's got that reputation too as being a creepy poet, scary poet.
Yep, yep.
And her you know biography supports this. She died of suicide. She had two small children. She had a kind of apocalyptic marital breakdown that contributed to her suicide. And some of her poems are quite grisly. You have this grotesque imagery. So, the scary reputation is to an extent justified, too.
It's interesting because I've interviewed her daughter several times just a couple of years ago. And basically, I mean, she feels like Sylvia left her to take care of Ted. which was no great thing as he became more of an alcoholic. So there's a lot of resentment there. But this is an amazing poet for you to write about. But why only six poems?
Well, that's part of the business side of it, with which I had really nothing to do. So the Library of America is doing a series of books on poets, and a poet will take on the task of writing essays about these poems, commenting about them, well, first choosing them. And it depends on the archive and the estate, what the poems cost, and so how big a selection you can get. None of these selections is big.
No.
They originally wanted to get more than six poems, and then they got six, and I don't really know about the whole business end of that.
And they're arranged in your book chronologically, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So you start with one of her early mature poems, and you end with a poem that was probably one of the last poems she ever wrote?
Mm. Yes.
Wow.
And that's quite deliberate. Because I wanted these essays to form a sort of biography of her as a writer.
And that's the way it comes off. I mean, I read the entire book, and that's exactly what happens with this. It's like her autobiography illustrated with her poems. I think it's really brilliantly done. It's nice.
Yeah, I think she really, really deserves this. So the Plath biography has been kind of an obsession. There's a great concentration on her personal life and on her, purported madness. And, I wanted to look at her life as the life of a very stubbornly developing, very hardworking writer. So I look at, for example, the story of her big leaps forward, not as stories of her, personal self-expression spurred by big events in her life, like her first suicide. I look at these big breakthroughs instead as being primarily caused by her having time and leisure and space in which to write and express herself, which she really had. These were very few and rather short periods of her life when she could, take the time and really develop her gift and relax a little bit and come out with some of her playful self. Because she had a really difficult life. She lost her father very early.
You can say that again. My God.
Yeah.
Talk about her. Let's talk about her parents and her mother and her father.
Yeah, okay. So she's from immigrant stock. And her father was, he was the absolute model of a striving immigrant. He had to start over professionally several times. He did it with unstinting work. And in his second marriage, he became a professor, he married, he had two children, he was finally settled. And then he was so self-reliant that when he got really sick, he self-diagnosed terminal and wouldn't get medical care. And what the truth was, he had diabetes and he neglected it for so long and he died of it.
Wow.
Leaving a wife and two small children to fend for themselves because being so self-reliant, he didn't trust insurance men. He didn't have any insurance. He left the family in this mess because he was the ultimate immigrant type.
Now, let's talk about her relationship with her mother. I just want to make sure we cram in as much as we can because you put so much information in this book. Her relationship with her mother is really interesting.
Yeah. This was I don't think anybody at this point in PLAS studies is calling it a healthy relationship.
Good point.
Some people have more regard for the mother than others do. I tend to be less regardful.
Okay.
This was, in any degree, a pretty awful relationship.
Yeah.
So the mother was, she was rather creative and ambitious herself, but she didn't have, studied to a master's degree, but there was no profession open to her except marriage, essentially. So she got married to this rather older man who was, he had this strict German academic temperament, so she was suppressed. She was in a subordinate role in this relationship, and she admits, you know, in her own writing, that she did this to keep the peace. And then this man on whom she was totally dependent, you know, up and dies through his own folly. And so this left her very, very resentful. And it's plain that she was very envious of her little girl, who was going to have a chance with some effort and some sacrifice, was going to have a chance to get a lot farther than she had.
Mm. Now, you write it a lot, in a lot of detail, about the things that Sylvia Plath faced as a woman in mid-20th century. It's basically a lot of academic misogynism that she had to face. Mm. Now, that's combined with the fact that she's struggling with depression and goes through hospitalization and for that time period, pretty brutal treatments.
Right. Yes. She went, this is her first major breakdown. They were experimenting at the time with electroshock therapy for depression.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, it was just being used as a way to discipline unhappy women and girls. Women and girls who were, for very good reason, discontented and struggling and depressed because of their circumstances. The original version of electroshock therapy was sadistic. You didn't have anesthetic, so you would be conscious of the fire-like sensation of the electroshock and the convulsions. And some people had their backs broken by this experience. Yeah, this was her first version of electroshock therapy. It was literally a torture.
Now,
she went through that, yes.
So, okay, she goes through that. Then she ends up marrying Ted Hughes. Talk to me about Ted Hughes for people who've never heard of him before.
Right. Now, Ted Hughes was almost an opposite character. Well, what they had in common was this passion for poetry. He was rather... quite a spoiled son of shopkeepers in rural Yorkshire. They were kind of the only people who were eagerly surviving through the Depression. Practically the only family in their neighborhood who was well off. He kind of ran wild as a boy. I mean, he was bright, and he got. You know, that Oxbridge scholarship, so with which he didn't really do much. He was, after he graduated with a pretty bad degree, he was just hanging with a group of artist type.
So, I mean, it ended up being an abusive relationship on several levels. Go ahead.
Yes. He was Abuse and brutality were more or less part of his poetic philosophy. You know, favorite topics of his are hunting, the death of animals, the nature with the red in tooth and claw, as Tennyson would have put it. And she kind of she's viscerally kind of attracted to this because she's this is sort of punished, being punished is what she's used to. But the marriage is very, very wearing, very hard on her health, draining of her energy. She put a lot of work into promoting him as a poet, and this was work that he was not willing to do. He just wanted to sit around and express himself. And she took on all the work of typing up his poems, and sending them out and getting him published, getting him funding, making him well-known. So he admits that she made him as a poet, and she did this at the expense of her own career. And then when he's making money, he decides that he is tied down and crushed, you know, as an artist by the domestic life that she is demanding. He didn't really want a second child, and he rebels. He has more than one affair, and he throws her aside. She is destroyed emotionally by this, but she has, this is really her great opportunity. She has a couple of opportunities before this to be on her own, express herself, say exactly what she wants on paper. And so she does this. She's living alone on their rural property. And she writes most of her greatest poems right there. She writes a few others in the flat in London to which she moves a few months later. So in a way, the breakup was a big opportunity for her to be herself as a poet. And you cannot understand the suicide as simply a response to romantic disappointment.
Got it.
That doesn't make sense, nor does it make sense that she simply went crazy, because when you go crazy, any artistic gift you have goes with it.
That's right.
People do not, you know, when they're actually raving mad, they can't do anything as artists. And she was obviously really clear-headed the whole time.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is writer, classicist, translator, Sarah Rudin. And we're talking about her book, I Am the Arrow, The Life and Art of Sylvia Plath in Six Poems. Where does the title I Am the Arrow comes from?
That comes from perhaps her most famous poem called Ariel. Hmm. And this is one of the poems that she wrote during the autumn of 1962. So she was abandoned. She was living on the property in Devon that she and Hughes had required. Hughes had run off at this point. And she was riding a horse as recreational. The horse was called Ariel. And she combines these riding sessions with the memory of riding a runaway horse back when she was a student. And the poem depicts a wild ride into annihilation. But it's also the story of the freeing of the poetic gift.
Right.
Everything is running away in backwards. All the things that bound the poet, all the things that held her down are slipping away. They are this landscape that's disappearing, and she's going off like an arrow into the sunrise. She's dying, but she's becoming immortal.
Can I get you to read one of her poems from your book?
Sure.
Like, and it'll be the first one, Mushrooms?
Yes, this is This is the first one.
Now, she wrote this while she was pregnant?
Yes, she was pregnant, and she was a resident in the Yaddo Writers Colony. That's in outside, right outside of Saratoga, New York.
And she loved her time there.
She loved her time. That was her first big breakthrough because she was well-sheltered, well-fed. She had all the leisure she wanted. There was a lovely library that she could browse at will. And she could just relax and express herself. So she started to blossom as a poet only when she started working less hard.
Let's hear the poem.
Overnight, very whitely, discreetly, very quietly, our toes, our noses, take hold on the loam, acquire the air. Nobody sees us, stops us, betrays us. The small grains make room. Soft fists insist on heaving the needles, the leafy bedding, even the paving, our hammers, our rams, earless and eyeless, perfectly voiceless, widen the crannies, shoulder through holes. We diet on water, on crumbs of shadow, bland-mannered, asking little or nothing. So many of us, so many of us. We are shelves, we are tables, we are meek, we are edible, nudgers and shovers in spite of ourselves. Our kind multiplies. We shall by morning inherit the earth, our foot's in the door.
That was the first time I had read the poem, was reading your book. I'd not read her Mushrooms before. And there's a weird element about it, because first of all, it's very fungal. I mean, it really takes the elements of how fungus exists and then uses that as a metaphor. Her language, and you write about this a lot in the book, she really was a master of language and really put a lot of effort in the way that she wrote things down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had been a very, very earnest student of literature from her early teens, really. She had been part of the high school class of a man called Wilbury Crockett. He was one of the best teachers in America, and he had a special select class that read great literature. So his most mature and most diligent, most mature and most diligent students in this high school would take this class, and they would get a sort of graduate level seminar in world literature. So she was one of his most accomplished students ever, probably the most accomplished. She worked very, very hard, and actually she worked too hard, because she imitated poets, modernist poets, particularly later on confessional poets. And so she would pick out a poet who was very fashionable among the academic elite, and then she would ruthlessly imitate this poet, which, you know, didn't really have a good effect because this was not her voice. The poet's experience was not her own. So she only really burst out when she was taken seriously as a poet herself by being given this fellowship to Yaddo and being told, okay, you just live here, we'll take care of you, and do your thing. And then she thought, aha, I can do my thing, and she started to do it. So one of the poems she wrote at Yaddo is Mushrooms. And it's not like anything else. This is Sylvia Plath herself.
It's a fascinating poem. It really doesn't sound like anything else. And
right.
She does have a playful element, and you write about that. It's a dark playful element. There's an edge to it, and that's what's fascinating.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, her father was a natural scientist. He was an expert on bees. And as a very little girl, as a toddler, she was taught, scientific names of insects and plants. And she could recite them. So she's always a keen student of nature, a great observer. And here her diligence, answered her needs very, very well. She was also an accomplished artist. She was very accurate in sketching. So she liked to sketch natural scenes. And she sort of brought this precise vision into a very willful and creative vision of the world.
Wow. We're completely out of time, which is too bad because there's a lot more I'd like to talk to you about this book. But people need to read your writing about her poetry, which I think is fascinating. But I'll end with this. You argue for, and this is a quote, Plath's establishment on purely literary merit in the cool mainstream of literary greatness. I love that sentence.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
So it's a pleasure to have you. My guest tonight has been, a returning guest tonight, is writer, classicist, translator Sarah Rudin. We're talking about her book, and I think it's a really great introduction into the works of Sylvia Plath. I Am the Arrow, The Life and Art of Sylvia Plath in 6 Poems. Sarah, it's a pleasure talking to you again.
Pleasure to be here.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.